This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
What's your bars? Did you get the bars? That's a real Derry one, I'm told. Everyone here knows what it means. What's the news? What's the gossip? What's the story? It's a common enough greeting everywhere in Ireland. In the Irish language, it's Enniscéal. And in Dublin, where I come from, it's often abbreviated to an even shorter story, meant as a greeting, not even a question. But what are the bars? The answer brings us right into the communal core of the biggest industry in Derry, Londonderry's past, the manufacture of shirts. The shirt factories are now defunct, their legacy visible only in the many large empty buildings which seem to hold up the town. The names of the factories, Tilly and Henderson's, Welch Markison, Rosemount, the Star Factory, Ben Sherman's, Viella and many others, declared themselves boldly on these huge 19th century Victorian structures. The explanation of the bars was given to me by Roy Arbuckle, a singer-songwriter and founder of Different Drums of Ireland. Different drums are the lambeg and the baron, and played together their sound symbolically unite the two communities in Northern Ireland. The context was a story-sharing session in a beautiful building on Patrick Street, which was once the city shirt factory. Now, thanks to Derry's Year of Culture, the factory has become an art centre, one part of which is the Shirt Factory Project. This unique installation by artist Rita Duffy aims to connect the artwork to the lives, skills and stories of the generations of women who worked in the industry when the Derry factories supplied top-of-the-range shirts to dress the upper-class gentlemen. Roy Arbuckle is from the Fountain area of the city. He had never been in this particular factory before. He took a look around at the beautiful white shirts floating like ghostly wraiths against the tiled walls, at the young women who are busy sewing new products from old shirt material, and then at the bank of dusty sewing machines, relics of the industrial past. "There's the bars," he said, pointing out the metal shafts which held the machines together. When anyone had news or gossip to pass on in the noisy factory, full of women working, they would rattle the bars with their scissors, wait for silence, then pass on the story. "I gave your mother and father the bars when they got engaged," a Derry woman told Roy on discovering which Arbuckle he was. The story of the shirt factories and the women and men who worked there is one part of the many stories of Derry. It's a part I've discovered that people like to remember. A time when the pink Derry shirt was known the world over and the women of the town were often the breadwinners thanks to the relatively well-paid work in the factories. For the storytelling sessions with which I was involved, I had to explore not just Derry shirts, but the folklore and history behind this most flexible piece of clothing. The shirt began its life as underwear and evolved through the ages of linen and flannel and cotton and silk and a plethora of man-made fibres to become a signature of the values and status of the man in the street or the boardroom or the bedroom. My first visit to Derry was in the late 1970s. The journey from Dublin at the time, whether by bus or in a car, took hours and hours on long winding roads, followed by the inevitable tense, boring wait at the border checkpoint outside Auchnacloy. First came customs, generally a wave away, then the forced politeness of the young British soldier at the checkpoint, only doing his job, but still asking intrusive personal questions about who, where, when, and why we were crossing the border at all. But the first sight of Derry City, as we drove along the road from Oma and Strabane, following the ever-widening River Foyle, caught the heart off guard and blew it open, to quote Seamus Heaney, and has done so for me ever since. Cradled in against the gentle green mountains of Inishowen, the small houses seemed to pour down the hill towards the town, which was perfectly constructed for the defence of its citizens, with its famous walls, spires of two cathedrals, the imposing edifice of the Guildhall, and a harbour which opens its long arms to the sea. But come closer and cross over Craigavon Bridge, and reality kicked in. The ravages of the bitter war that had erupted some years previously had destroyed houses and emptied buildings, and the streets were patrolled by the army and the police. I was there to record a story for RTE Television on the work that was being done by the Derry Youth and Community Workshop. This workshop had been set up by community activist Paddy Doherty and others, including Margot Harkin, now a well-known Derry filmmaker. Young people from very disadvantaged backgrounds were being given training in practical skills, and in the process they were restoring the many buildings which had been destroyed by the IRA bombing campaign. The atmosphere in the workshop, as I remember it, was tough and confrontational, with leaders often provocative in their insistence that the young people take responsibility for their own lives and work. The young people seethed with inarticulate anger and were challenging, to say the least. Their usual mode of expression included colourful expletives or truculent silence. Paddy Doherty had the inspired idea of appointing as communications officer a young lad whose only form of communication was through sign language, as he was both deaf and dumb. There was no choice but to learn another way of communicating, to invent a shared language, and those young people did rise to the challenge. Then 2 years later, in 1980, I returned to Derry in an entirely different role. This time it was to play the part of Moy Chathach in the first production of Brian Friel's wonderful and prescient play, Translations. How that play came to open at the Guildhall in 1980 has become another part of the story, not just of Derry, but of theatre history. That such a play, from a master playwright, delving as it does into the complexities of language, map-making, myth, and the death of a culture, should appear at this time with the full support of the City Council was nothing short of a miracle. Translations is set in a hedge school in the fictitious townland of Ballybeg in County Donegal in 1833, long before partition. The Royal Engineers of the British Army are engaged in an ordnance survey of the entire island of Ireland. The Irish place names are being translated to English for the purpose of a new map. I played the part of Moya, the local girl who falls in love with a British soldier, one of the map makers. It was his job to translate the local Irish place names into the Queen's English. They are divided by history and language. She speaks only Irish and he English. In their attempts to communicate, the lovers resort to the only words they share, the words of the place names which are being translated. Bonnachon, Drimdu, Polnaguirach, Lismuil, Lisnungra, the magic place of love. On the opening night in the Guildhall, despite the tension of politics, with army helicopters flying overhead and the ever-present threat of violence, the standing ovation was led by the Ulster Unionist Party Lord Mayor, Marlene Jefferson. For those of us who were engaged in the Field Day Theatre productions, and I was involved in three of them, it was work, but exciting work, living as we were in very dark times. It was the time of the hunger strikes and the intransigence of the Thatcher government, which led to funeral after funeral. The flags that flew in Derry then were mainly black. Now, as I walk around the lively streets full of cafes and shops and families with lots of children and curious visitors soaking up the history and atmosphere of it all, I marvel at the changes. As I do when I call in for coffee at the Guildhall and see that the room we rehearsed in is now the council chamber of the City of Derry, Londonderry. Across the busy road is the walkway to the beautiful undulating Peace Bridge, which now crosses the wide river and leads to the redeveloped expanse of Ebrington Barracks on the waterside, once the heart of the British military control of the city. It will be a lasting legacy of the city of culture. All is changed utterly. There has been a long, slow picking up of torn threads and the spinning of a new story, the weaving of a cloth of many colours, a mix of green, white and orange, with hues of red and blue and splashes of yellow stars from Europe, for the creation of a new shirt, worn close to the skin, both for show and to protect the wearer. So what's the Bars now? Who knows? There are many versions of the story of Derry's past. During the storytelling sessions at the Shirt Factory project, I listened to the women and some men who worked in the factories. I now know what a boxer is, a tail finisher, a grabber, a cuffer, how to make a toasty from a hot smoothing iron, what plaster money is, and how to keep a good hairdo in after working all day. The stories I heard from the women are full of earthy energy and hard work. "I worked in Tilly and Henderson's and I was not a slave," declared one woman, Frances, defiantly. She worked all her life, and when her children were young, she took the machine home so she could work at night when they were asleep. She was a fast worker and did well on the piecework system. The basic wage was known as a man's wage. She would share some of her pieces with her friend Sadie, who was slower, because Sadie used to sing when she worked, and singing was important. Singing kept them going. Through births, romance, marriages and death, the work, tedious and mundane as it must have been at times, gave them freedom and power. Let there be legends, reports and analyses from this year in Derry, Londonderry or Legendary, but let there be work too. Without work, the stories are for the air and will fade away. I'll finish as I began, with an old shirt story. In seeking poems and stories about shirts, I came across a very ancient Irish text. It was written in the year 900 in Old Irish. It is called The Lament of the Old Woman of Beara, and I came across it in, of all places, Book 4 of the Field Day Anthology of Irish Writing. This has become known as the Women's Volume, but that's another story. It is said to be the first poem ever attributed to a woman in Ireland. She was a nun who was once married. She's called Digda, and this is her lament in old age. Is me chaliach ver a bui, the chachin leine hir nua, ach an schkele ta agam anew, nach gachin ach leine ach laive. I am the old hag of Beara. I used to wear fine new shirts, but now the state I'm in, I only have second-hand ones. Or more elegantly translated by the Derry poet Seamus Dean, part of it goes, "It was a small release then to jump the traces as I did. Youth briefly blazes, and play or no play, the shirt with times increases would wear out anyway."